Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we're bringing you, in this bitter cold season, a little warming charm from a contingent that I call the Booze Bunch.
Oh, is that what you call them? Well,
yes.
I guess it is a boozy bunch, but they're a little different.
They're very different, actually.
Very different things. Well, I will actually wind up with a rather conventional track about a rather conventional, but in their own way, unconventional California winery. But starting out today, a beverage product that I wouldn't be surprised if some of you in the audience never heard of bitters.
Yeah, and as we mentioned, it's bitters and amari, which is a very hot trend right now.
And who better to introduce us to this whole subject than a man who has the right last name to talk about bitters? His name is Mark Bitterman of the Meadows and goodness knows what else.
New York and Portland, Oregon.
And a man who has done yeoman work for those of you who want to explore the wonderful world of things that aren't quite so sweet. Mark Bitterman, welcome back to On the Menu Radio. We're delighted that you joined us again.
Thank you so much for having me.
This book you just produced, is it back to your roots? It is, in a way. It's sort of very, very well all the way back to your original discovery of the delight of sneaking booze out of your parents' liquor cabinet. Well, you owned up to that.
I did. I was actually sneaking booze out of my parents' liquor cabinet way before I was actually interested in drinking. I was just interested in the flavors, and I liked the kind of novelty of serving grown-up things that thought was kind of cute, and that this kid was making them cocktails, and they probably were awful, but my parents were courteous and supportive, so they drank them.
Oh, okay. So after you snuck into the liquor cabinet, they found out, and they decided there must be something useful you could do with your newfound knowledge?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Put them to work.
Well, let's say right up front here that what we're talking to is this really splendid book called The Field Guide to Bitters and Amari. And Mark Bitterman, this production of this book is gorgeous. It's made to look like it's leather-bound, but it's not, of course. But it's that kind of classy book. And it's meant to be a long-term resource for cocktail people, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It has really, I think, an exhaustive survey of a field that's at the core of craft cocktails today. And it's intended to give people, I would say, a contemporary insight into cocktails, how to shift flavors away from the sugary, sweet, syrupy drink of the past.
Yeah, thank you. I hate that stuff.
Absolutely, yeah.
Now, you started out explaining about how people turned away from bitters. It was one way to avoid toxic substances. But you don't really explain why it is that all of a sudden, well, first of all, preserved for centuries, is this affinity for bitters in one form or another, and then why all of a sudden is everybody craving bitters now if it's a signal, evolutionary signal of something toxic?
Yeah, that's an interesting theory. We definitely identify in our primal nervous centers that there are very high beneficial qualities to bitter alkaloids and bitter properties in plants. And so, when we're sick, we instinctively would turn to some of these things and eat them. But it's very possible that maybe there's just something awry and we're drawn to this as a curative. But it's also possible that it's just a sign of our maturing food ways. You know, people have never lost sight of bitter flavors in many countries. And in America, we did. Maybe we're just maturing back into a more cosmopolitan and global appetite, global taste.
Yeah, we interviewed the woman who wrote the book on bitter having to do with vegetables mainly, Jennifer Laughlin. And it was a wonderful surprise. And it indicated that it was an acquired taste, that if you ate bitter things early on, you're more likely to continue to favor bitter things. Do you think that's true?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've traveled a lot in foreign countries, and you see people don't have kids' meals in foreign countries. They have food that it's the same food that the grown-ups are eating, and maybe a few treats here and there. But I think in countries where I've seen a prevalence, a predominance of bitter preferences, kids are being fed bitter food from the day they're born.
Now, it's interesting, though, and I don't want to skim over this because we sort of touched on the subject already, but not thoroughly. It seems that the original bitters, in fact, were medicinal. They were things that had apparent curative effect. So they were part of the, if you like, the resource of the pharmacist of the past, or the doctor of the past, and maybe it was simply that you could easily convince someone it was doing them good if it tasted bad.
The ethanol that's in any alcoholic beverage, the ethanol is extremely effective at pulling various different botanical properties, different desired properties out of the botanical. So it's basically an extraction technology using soaking food, soaking botanicals in alcohol. So you can, by extracting the active ingredients, you can actually create more concentrated medicines than by eating just a bunch of plants. Also, of course, it has staying power. You could put things that maybe are only available seasonally into alcohol, extract the active ingredients, and then you have a lasting medicine. So that's been around actually longer than most people could even imagine. The earliest alcoholic beverage ever found was, I don't remember exactly the dates, but roughly, give or take, 8,000 years ago, there was a barley, I think, and rice wine alcoholic beverage that was infused with hawthorn berries, which were a medicine, a bitter medicine, by the way. And then to sweeten it, they added honey. So what you basically have is 8,000 years ago, a medicinal alcoholic beverage medicine that was sweetened with honey. So it was just like an Amaro today. The same exact drinks are being made today.
Now, it's interesting because over the years I've discovered that if I have a fever, for example, one way to break it is to make a hot toddy, which, of course, you know, the only bitter ingredient that's sort of generally around is lemon and lemon peel. And then you add sugar or honey, and then you add the booze of your choice, and then you add hot water, and you imbibe that. And then you take 6 aspirin and rush off to bed, and lo and behold, in the morning you wake up and you're better.
I'm a big believer. I always kid around that I drink tequila when I'm getting sick, but I actually do. That and lots of salt, of course. But I actually have a bitter toddy recipe in the book.
There's every recipe known to man in this book. It's not a very big book, but the print is pretty small.
Well, you know, my theory is that Mark Bitterman has a very large brain. I don't know how else to describe what this book is like. It's everything in there, Mark.
I'm not sure if that's a compliment. That's funny. But, I like to explore a subject in some detail, and I think what I like to do with this book is, you know, like the cocktail recipes, for example, there's a foundational recipe, a master recipe, say, for a martini, but then I create a little chart where you could then substitute out a different Amaro or vermouth or a different bitters, and you create a whole variety of different types of martinis that are really quite different and distinctive just by using a simple formula. So I like to kind of I like to explore something and then see how you can apply it to make things simpler and, frankly, more reliable, because the number of unreliable drinks out there is a crime.
Well, now you're a man with some very distinctive opinions. I mean, you sound sort of soft-voiced and malleable.
No.
until we read this book. And then I don't know what you said exactly about that. I don't remember exactly what you said about the Manhattan, but it wasn't very complimentary.
Well, I like that Manhattan, but they started off bad in the old days. I swear, I grew up drinking them, and they had the horrible cherries in them, and they were always sweet and stickly, and
I
a lot of
Manhattan
were beautiful.
Plastic.
One of the I'm stumbling over the word I want. One of the variations that was created with the Negroni has something else unexpected in it. What was it that somebody introduced gin into it for the first time? I can't remember the story.
The Americano was a drink that didn't have gin into it. Then Count Campari actually introduced gin into the Americano, and that's what created a longer, leaner drink that's not as cloying as sweet. And then in my recipe, I actually pull back even more on the Campari and sweet vermouth, and the idea is to create kind of a leaner, more booze-forward drink, but then we fill in the gap with bitters. So you actually still have a dense flavor and bitterness, but a leaner, more boozy drink, not at all as cloying and sugary as all that Campari and sweet vermouth.
Now, but Campari was actually created by a man called Count Campari?
Sorry, it was Count Negroni
Negroni, okay.
It was Gaspari, I think, Campari, I think it was, invented Campari. And I think he was the fellow, I get him confused. One was from, the Campari inventor was from, I think, Turin. And then the inventor of the Campano Antica vermouth was from Milan. And then, I forget quite how it goes. There's a love story involved, is all I remember, that the guy who invented the Campari combined the Campano Antica vermouth with the Campari and created something called a Torino Milano, one of the others, for his girlfriend, so they could commute back and forth and drink together. Okay. But then it was Count Negroni who introduced the gin. He's the guy that I admire.
Okay. Now we should clarify something else before we get too far away from it and I forget, because you create a distinction. You don't actually express it in quite these words, but there's a substantial part of the book is about bitters, which you add to or mix with something else to make a cocktail, and then there are beverages which are all bitter, like Amaro, and you have a section on Amaro. Perhaps you can take just a moment to explain what Amaro is.
Yeah, that's a great question and a great distinction. So, the book is called Bitters and Amari. Amari is just plural for Amaro.
Yeah.
Amaro actually just means bitter in Italian. So we're using the Italian word to signify a class of alcoholic beverages that are bitter at their foundation. The difference between a bitter and an Amaro is that a bitter is designed to be used by the drop. So it comes in a small bottle with a dropper or a restrictor, so you can just shake it out by the dash. And an Amaro bottle comes in a large bottle designed to be poured into glasses. And believe it or not, that's really the fundamental difference. It's really a continuum. A bitters could be an Amaro, and an Amaro could be a bitters, but it's really how it's positioned and how it's used.
So, in a way, a vermouth is sort of like an Amaro, but not quite.
A vermouth is very much like an Amaro. Actually, vermouth comes from the German word vermut, or wormwood. And so, vermouth was originally a fortified wine with a bunch of botanicals, and then wormwood in it to make it bitter. And an Amaro would be the exact same thing, except instead of having fortified wine, it would just have alcohol, hard alcohol, spirit.
You have a lot of history in this book. And you also have a lot of oddball things. Like, what am I looking at here? Bitter buttered popcorn.
Yeah, well, it started because, I'm actually fundamentally a very lazy person. And I just am. I like things to look really good and taste really delicious. And I like people to be kind of amazed and feel special and loved. But I'm lazy. I don't want to do all this fancy work and stuff. So I'm always looking for what I would call shortcuts or cheats. And I'm making popcorn all the time because it's so good. And it's good with drinks and it's good with movies and all that. And I just started putting bitters in the butter. I'm like, why not? Throw some bitters in there. And you've got this is an extract of a whole bunch of botanicals. And so I make my popcorn with a bunch of bitters in the butter. I'm like, well, it's flat out better. It's just tastier, crazy tasting. And there's all these different kinds of bitters. There's like Memphis barbecue bitters in a popcorn. Spicy and smoky and just delicious. So, yeah, it all stems from my interest in cheating and taking shortcuts.
I wanted to ask you two questions. One is, explain this part five, your field guide to bitters, and what's in that section. And secondly, you need to mention your shops and how you've stocked them with these drinks. And also that bitter, the service you have for cocktail chefs.
Sure, absolutely. So first, just with regards to the field guide, so the book that we're talking about, the Field Guide to Bitters and Amari, it's broken down to a handful of different sections. The beginning is just a little bit of front matter on just, you know, where bitters come from and their history and what they are. And then after that is a section on how to make them. So really, some pretty simple but very effective recipes for making bitters at home. And I'm a big believer because it's really quite easy. You could just buy some hard alcohol, some Everclear or Bacardi 151, and any overproof alcohol and put a bunch of botanicals in them, and you get great homemade bitters. So that's that section. And there's a lot of recipes for them in there, and they're really a lot better than what you'll find on the Internet, I think. And then the second section is the cocktail section, where we talked about cocktails were often established. Some of them are really novel and weird. Some of them are just called, I would call, kind of contemporary refinements or modernizations of classic cocktails. And then a cookbook section as well, of course. So lots of recipes on food, everything from barbecue to popcorn.
Glad you mentioned that. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and cooking with bitters, as I mentioned, it's just a wonderful shortcut and a wonderful way to bring a kind of an unexpected little jolt to your food. And then the back of the book is the field guide, where I taste 500 different kinds of bitters. So I found all the bitters that I could find in the world. I've got 550 in my collection, but a lot of them are kind of defunct. And put 500 of them in there, and I did this. This is my what's the word? My contribution to society, or my gift to humanity, because it wasn't easy or fun to taste that many bitters in a row. I basically would go to the supermarket, and I'd fill the hatchback of my Subaru up with Ruffles potato chips, and go home, and have a drop of bitters, eat a potato chip, put some bitters in water, have a potato chip, put some bitters with some alcohol, have a potato chip, put some bitters with some food, have a potato chip. So I'm just eating potato chips and drinking bitters for weeks and weeks and weeks on end. Insane. And I definitely should have bought stock and Ruffles ahead of time. But I taste all these bitters and give them ratings. I scale the aromatic intensity from 1 to 5, so how strongly aromatic they are. Their bitterness and their sweetness, all on scales of 1 to 5. And then I give a brief summary of a flavor description or profile, sometimes just a vignette, and then suggested uses. So it's designed to be a really powerful resource for home and pro bartenders, because if you're looking for a flavor concept or you're looking to see what works or you're shopping, this book has that bitters in it, and it gives you the lowdown on them.
No, I thought that was great. I was going to come back to that when I was discussing the fact that you really seem to be rather opinionated, and you actually cast your opinion 1 through 5, where 5 is high and 1 is low.
Yeah, I mean, it helps, because you know, if you taste one thing, you're like, I think it's one of the things that even a lot of bitters makers have. It's a problem is they make their little precious darlings and they fall in love with them, but frankly, you got to taste it against the bad boys out there. There's some really serious, phenomenal creations in the world. And so I just do them all justice by putting them all up as equals. And some of them are not as powerful, not as strong, not as balanced, and not as interesting as others. And then some of them, any of them, are truly extraordinary and deserve to be recognized as such.
Now, people can actually get to you via the Internet if they're struggling in this space?
No, absolutely. I love to be available. I mean, the best resource available, not to toot my own horn, but it's my stores, The Meadow, located in Portland, Oregon, in New York City. We have a colossal, world-class selection of bitters in those stores, a couple hundred varieties minimum. And our staff are fanatics, and they love to get together, and we spend time one-on-one with whoever comes in. And we do that on the phone, too. So whether you're in the store or shopping on the Internet or just want to talk, we're always there. But I can also be reached by email.
Now, how do people do that?
Go to my website, markbitterman.com, and you can just fill in the form, and I get back to you.
Okay, so it's mark, no punctuation, bitterman.com.
Yeah. I think that's your work.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Now, I've got to go make Sazerac Chopino.
Oh, yeah. That sounds like the thing to do on a day like today.
Exactly.
We could talk all day. We just did a whole one-hour program on artisanal English gin.
I want to hear that.
You'll have to listen to it. It was about two weeks ago. And in the meantime, I hope we'll catch up with you one of these days and keep up the great work of providing insightful opinion on all subjects related to bitters, chocolate.
Salt.
You got it.
You name it.
If I must.
And have a great day, Mark.
Mark, thanks again. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, you guys.
And if you thought that was unusual, wait till you hear the track that's following the break. So don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Here we are again. And who knew that you could grow grapes at 9,200 feet above sea level? And along those lines, who can tell me what the state spirit or liquor is of Bolivia?
Yeah, we thought we'd sampled just about everything.
Yeah, well, this is new. It's called Singani, and here we are talking to somebody about just what it is and how it's going to break forth in a great spirit in the United States pretty soon, or is already doing so.
You're probably not actually going to believe this, but Catherine Fritz Young, who's talking to us now as part of our next interview at On the Menu Radio, actually grew up in Bolivia. And we haven't covered where she learned to speak such immaculate English, but I guess there was a family connection on both of those things. Correct, Catherine?
That is correct. I grew up truly bilingual, speaking both English and Spanish at the same time, learning them at the same time. Otherwise, quite frankly, I don't know if I'd know two languages because I'm not very good at languages in general. So I was very fortunate that I was able to not only learn them at the same time, but also then acquire the accents of both Spanish and English at the same time.
And you lived until you were of college age in this rather exotic country, which is also known for the fact that it's also rather high.
Well, yes, I was actually born and grew up in La Paz, Bolivia, which is rather high. It's a little under 14,000 feet above sea level. And although it's considered exotic to me, I knew nothing different. And when I came to the United States, I thought the United States was exotic. And I came here to go to college when I was about 18 years old and ended up, in the long story short, marrying an American and staying here.
So here you are in the United States, but you still have a connection with Bolivia, and the Bolivian connection that we're talking about today is a beverage.
A beverage
which we had never heard of. We thought we'd heard of and drunk most everything, but Singani somehow passed us by. Can you explain, Catherine, what it actually is?
Well, Singani is a very unique spirit, and Bolivia is a country for a very, very long time, although this is changing very quickly. It wasn't a country that was was a part of the common knowledge. When I tell people I was from Bolivia, they'd think I was talking about Bulgaria in Europe, and I'd say, no, this is South America. And so there was very little knowledge known about the country, but also what the country has to offer in terms of cuisine and unique beverages. And Singani certainly falls in that realm. You know, it all started it was 2006. I was visiting my brother in D.C., and we, of course, as part of our ritual of meeting, we were eating salteñas, and I was making a dish called sacta de pollo, and we were remiss that we couldn't find Singani to have with our dinner. And we thought, well, gee, if we miss Singani here in this country, certainly there are many other Bolivians that missing Denny in this country, and we decided we'd do something about that. And spent a good 5 to 6 years really digging in deep to understand what we needed to do and to import Singani into this country and which Singani company to partner with. And Singani basically is a spirit that is made very similar to the eau de vie process, which is characterized with really fruity flavors, typical of the fruit that it's made from, very light, very clean type of palate. And the particular grape that's used in Singani is from the Muscat family, and so it's got some really pronounced aromatic flavors that you would associate with white grapes. Yes.
Now, it's a little bit like Pisco?
Not at all like Pisco.
Not at all, okay.
No, I don't think it tastes like, it doesn't taste at all like Pisco.
See, I thought it tasted a little bit like a cross between Pisco and Grappa.
Yeah, there's a little Grappa.
Yeah, there is a little grappa, and grappa is made from the urbanin kind of process. It's more of a mash type of process, so it's got harsher flavors. I don't think it is anything at all like Pisco, and I like Pisco quite a bit.
Yeah, I do too, but I don't think it's like it either.
Well, every man is entitled to his opinion, even though most of the women in the world don't seem to think so.
Now, Catherine, tell us about altitude.
Hold on a second. Is it actually made from grape juice, or is it made from the
musk?
Musk, like a grappa?
Well, you make a musk, but you really use the juice.
Okay.
And so it doesn't retain, for a variety of reasons, it's partially because of the altitude of where the grape grows, which gives it unique characteristics. And the way that it's made, it takes off those, what I would call, harsh notes. I've got a sensitivity to bitter notes, for example, and so I don't tolerate them well. And much like Pisco, which I absolutely like, but I could never drink on its own, the drinks that Pisco taste good and are made with ingredients that really mask some of the unpleasant taste and allow the more pleasant taste to surface in the drink. Now, egg whites is a great masking agent for harsh flavors, and it's no coincidence that lime juice is used heavily in mixed drinks because it too kind of tempers some of the harsher, less pleasant flavors. You don't need to do that with Pisco. Pisco is more of a sipping spirit, or my preference is to combine it with ingredients that are more mild tasting, so you don't take away those fresh grape aroma flavors.
I would
ask anybody that, you know, if you're curious about Pisco versus Singani, to sit down with a little bit of each and taste them side by side, and you wouldn't even think they're related. They're made from white grapes, but they don't taste anything alike.
Now, Singani is the state liquor, isn't it, of Bolivia?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. It's a state liquor. It has a domain that is highly protected by the Bolivian government, so it can only be made in a very small area of the country and only in Bolivia in that small area, much like champagne is protected and cognac is protected. Although the land, the domain in Bolivia is much smaller in terms of the acreage than something like champagne and cognac. But yes, it is the state liquor.
And how do people drink it there in Bolivia?
Primarily, it is drunk as what's called a chufly, which is Singani with a little bit of ginger ale or a very lightly flavored lemon-lime soda. And I don't know if you have tasted it that way, but that, and you might put a little slice of lime or a little slice of lemon in there, but certainly no juice. And it allows, again, for you to be able to taste those flavors that are very unique and singular to Singani, which are, it almost tastes like you're biting into a fresh green grape. Now, I know that there have been a lot of other cocktails used with more trendy, modern ingredients. I can't attest to how well other people like those. I grew up with the traditional, and maybe that's why I like it, but I feel that the stronger ingredients tend to take away the unique flavor profile of Singani. The other way that I like it is in Sugumbe, which is also somewhat traditional to Bolivia, and it's made with hot milk. And milk's got a very bland flavor in and of itself. So it allows it, you can put a little bit of spices in there, like a cinnamon and nutmeg and what, but that's a fun way to drink it as well, particularly during the winter.
Yeah, it's a hot drink.
Yeah.
Now, these grapes, they must be pretty hardy. I mean, it's Bolivia's right up there. I mean, La Paz is on top of the world, like Nepal.
Yeah, you know, the people who are native from that area, and we adopted a little girl from that area, their lungs are actually physically bigger than the rest of the world. They've adapted throughout generations.
Wow.
To be able to bring more oxygen into their body, because oxygen is so scarce up there.
It's funny you should say that, because back when I was in high school, we had an exchange teacher who came to us from La Paz.
And
he came to Yorkshire, England, where the elevation is about 500 feet. And he, after about 3 or 4 months, he had to go home because he couldn't get his blood pressure under control.
Oh, interesting.
So he had terrible problems with elevated blood pressure, because he'd spent his entire life, I guess, at 14,000 feet.
Right, and his biology was probably very, very different. You know, whenever I go back home as often as I can, and if I stay there for an extended period of time, when I come back to the U.S., all I can tell you is I have a feeling of heaviness.
Huh.
It's just a general feeling of heaviness, and I don't know if it's psychological or not, but when I go back to La Paz, because I'll travel to other places around Bolivia, but when I go to La Paz, I feel physically better. And again, it might be psychological, but I think there's something to do with the air pressure there that makes me feel better.
Well, I think you're just used to that. Now, if we went...
We'd get altitude sickness.
We would have much more difficulty. Now, the only thing I could put up against that is I did some consulting work in Mexico a decade or so ago, and we worked in Mexico City, and then we also worked in a place called Toluca, which is about...
Yep, I'm familiar with Toluca, yep.
And we worked at 7,500 feet, and quite honestly, I was surprised we didn't notice at all.
Oh, that's great. Mm. You know, most of your aerobic capacity is inherited, so either you have a natural aerobic capacity and you can adapt to different altitudes more easily than people who don't have that. So you might have a natural aerobic capacity that allows you to adapt more easily than others.
It might have also been hourly consumption of tequila. You never thought about that. You've faced the challenge of getting a new liquor from as far as the U.S. is concerned, a new location into the United States. But to what extent are people going to be able to find Singali?
Well, you know, it was a big challenge, and I have to give credit to my brother, David Fritz. He spent a lot of time in paving the way of bringing Singali easily into the United States, and Fritz Reports was the first to do so. And, you know, it's a very good question, because I think the future will answer your question as to how easily it's going to be. At the moment, as you know, there are 3 importers of Singani, and each one is importing from one of the 3 major producers in Bolivia. I think, you know, when Steven came out with his brand of Singani 63, and because he has the ability to market his product more effectively, I think that's going to help with getting the message out and the awareness and consequently the availability. But us being the first, at first it was very difficult because nobody knew what it was, they didn't know how to relate to it, so on and so forth. I would say in the past year and a half, that awareness has been more exponential than it has been in the past. I mean, here in the United States, we're always looking for novelty. We like to explore and try different things.
And South America's having its moment.
It is. Peru had and continues to have a huge moment. Brazil was there for a while as well. Bolivia is becoming a little bit more renowned. Having lived in Chile a few years, I'm waiting for Chile to pop out because their cuisine is unique.
Lots of Chilean marketing going on.
Yeah. So I think the timing is right. Is it going to be the next tequila within my lifetime? Probably not. but I can see it gaining ground little by little. There are people in Chicago who are asking for it. We're trying to find a partner, distributor, to help get the product down there. Again, Stephen has done a great job at publicizing this out in the West Coast, on the East Coast, and that just is good for the rest of us who also are importing the product.
Now, how are people going to be able to get additional information through the Internet?
You know what? This is going to sound like it's self-serving, but the honest truth, the best source is Singani USA. A lot of the other websites have taken content from that website and put it in their own. And then another great resource of information is the Wikipedia. 99% of it was based on research done by Fritz Imports, and you'll find more than you ever want to know on Singani between the two of them.
That is www.singaniusa.com.
Correct. And then again, the Wikipedia site is complements the information in Singani USA as well.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you so much. As an integrated family unit, for getting us a sample.
You're quite welcome, and we appreciate having me and sampling the product.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing people's taste for it grow. It'll be interesting to watch the popularity and the taste grow in the United States for Singani.
Yes, it'll be fun for me as well, and again, I think one of the things that hasn't been kind of tapped into is that winter beverage as well. Most of what I see is more of the summery light beverages, but as we start to explore and find out about sucumbe, actually it was one of the drinks that Eric Calderon from Bolivia presented at the CIA in San Antonio as part of his menu of his dinner with sucumbe, and everybody just loved it. So it's much broader in terms of its usage than is being published at the moment. So I'm very excited to see it grow throughout the years.
Well, Catherine, thank you so much, and adios until the next time.
Adios. Hasta luego.
Hasta luego.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, for our last segment, I think we're going to segue into a more well-known area of alcoholic beverage called vino, wine. In this case, a really good vineyard that Peter had really a lot of fun talking to the winemaker and the rep about.
They have some very interesting ideas as to what a California winery that they own would like to be. And I'm sure you'll be very interested in that, so I won't steal their thunder. I will tell you the Chardonnay and the Pinot Noir that we sample from the Martin Ray wines in Green Valley, in the Russian River Valley in California, were really quite exceptional. And we can't, of course, bring you that other than by just telling you that. You're just going to have to go get some for yourself. But in the meantime, it's a very interesting story. It's a lucky afternoon for our next guests, Andy Barker and Bill Batchelor, because they're in sunny California, and of course we're in gloomy Pittsburgh. What's the weather like today?
This is Andy Barker, and the weather out here today is a little bit rainy, but it is some positive. That's a positive thing for us since we've had a little bit of drought this past couple years. But it's still warm, and weather is fine.
And the grapes are smiling.
Grapes are smiling. Yeah, this is Bill with Martin Ray, and we're very happy to see some rain. The grapes are just lapping it up, and you know it's a very welcome sight out in the vineyard currently.
I'm sure it is. Although you've been getting a little bit too much of the wet stuff.
So far, it's been okay. I mean, it's not enough that we. You know, it's prohibiting tractor work or that sort of thing. We're not flooded, but It's well needed, and I think the soil is so dry that it's most of it's going right in, and we're not seeing a lot of standing water.
Oh, that's wonderful. Anyway, we're talking this afternoon to representatives, and Bill is the winemaker. Sorry, Bill. I don't know why I'm having so much difficulty.
Okay.
And I think it's possibly because my partner in crime is having difficulty hearing because she has a very bad head cold, and she sounds a little bit frog-like as well. So she decided she would leave this today up to me. Fun anyway, because I always have a lot of fun talking about wine. After all, what's the next best thing to talking about wine? I don't know what it is, but it's way in second place.
Talking about beer.
Talking about beer, there you go. That would be just as good. Now, the Martin Ray Vineyard, who'd like to give us a little bit of the history?
This is Bill. I can tell you a little bit about the history of Martin Ray, where we came from and where we're going. Martin Ray was one of the original pioneers of California winemaking who came over and started making wine in the Santa Cruz Mountains area of California in the 1930s, 1940s, and trained under Paul Masson and some of the great masters of winemaking, and built up the brand as being a pretty historic winery at the time. And Martin Ray was one of the pioneering winemakers to use varietal-based labeling, you know, Cabernet, Pinot Noir, in contrary to just making blends of red wines and white wines, and really kind of elevated the bar for California winemaking throughout the 50s and 60s. And over time, he sort of faded into the background, and the current owner, Courtney Benham, bought the label from the Martin Ray family in around 1990, and we've carried it ever since, sort of maintaining his legacy.
Now, the person who bought the vineyard, he was able to do that probably because he had a day job, right?
Yeah, he was actually a young business college graduate who'd come from a farming family in Central California, and his family had worked with grapes and wine and wanted to get into the wine business, and essentially bought the label intrigued by the backstory behind it. There was, you know, a lot of history there, a lot of artifacts themselves, and really felt proud about bringing that label back and learned the ropes, you know, throughout the process, and has been very successful. But what was critical to the current owner, Courtney Benham, was to maintain the quality and the name of Martin Ray. Don't dilute that history that sits behind it, because he was a much heralded winemaker throughout California history.
Now, somewhere in the background information that I got, there was a statement about you were trying to make really excellent wines, but you were concerned about price point. You were concerned to make sure these wines were sufficiently affordable that people would be able to enjoy them without guilt.
Correct. This is Bill speaking again. The goal is essentially to over-deliver quality in the bottle and deliver wines that are, you know, very drinkable at all times and really hold more value than the actual bottle price. And I think it's something to be very proud of, to be able to deliver a wine, let's say, for $25 to $50 that normally would go for 30% more than that without cutting corners. It's just a matter of really taking each wine and approaching it very carefully and putting the best into it you can and not overcharging the consumer. You know, let's get our share out of it, but deliver a wine and make a wine that people can actually drink and afford to drink.
Well, no, I agree with that completely. And we've heard over the years that getting worse rather than better year by year, that California winemakers better be careful not to be too greedy, because otherwise their wines are going to appear to be too expensive, and the consumption of them is going to be considered more of a luxury. Now, that's a absolutely definite definition of how you want to go about business at Martin Ray.
Yeah, very much so. In fact, if you look at the back label on some of our wines, it says we make wine for the discerning masses. So quality, but available to everyone.
Well, this member of the discerning masses, by the way, enjoyed a Chardonnay 2013 vintage on Tuesday, and then last night we had an absolutely delicious Pinot Noir.
Thank you very much.
And these are the flagship wines of Martin Ray.
I believe, this is Andy speaking,
yes,
and
Andy.
I believe that you had our 2013 Mill Station Chardonnay and from the Green Valley, and you had our 2013 Dark Star Hill Pinot Noir. And yes, these are certainly some of our flagship wines in reference to the Chardonnay. I think Green Valley, you know, makes a quintessential Chardonnay, and certainly this, you know, what Bill and the winemaking team have done has certainly represented the area very well. And then the Pinot Noir again is from the Freestone area of the Russian River Valley. And again, with you know, that wine is classic for that, you know, that region.
Now, interestingly, these grapes, the Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, are grapes that are not exactly native, but they are grown, for the longest time in the region of France called Burgundy, and Burgundy has a quite distinctly different climate than does the Green Valley off the Russian River in California. How come you're so successful with it when it's blistering heat in the summertime, and certainly not what you get in France?
This is Bill speaking. Green Valley is actually a very cool area within Sonoma County. So it's a lower sort of valley pocket where it gets a lot of coastal influence and a lot of fog at night. So what you get is a good extreme variation on temperature. So the days are rather warm, but they're not blistering hot. And then as the afternoon comes and the night rolls in, the fog comes and cools the vines down. And where that benefits winemaking for us, especially for Chardonnay and Pinot, is it retains acidity and allows it to slowly ripen. So in a hot area, you essentially, you know, burn out your acidity and the grapes get flabby and you get sort of flabby, overripe wines. The Mill Station Chardonnay, which you tasted, is a great example of that, where it's one of the last wines we bring in every year because it takes so long to ripen. So I think that sort of condition and climate really contributes to that style, which, in my opinion, mimics Burgundy fairly well. Key here is we're not trying to mimic anybody. We're just trying to represent Green Valley. But it's essentially the cool nights really maintain structure on these wines.
Okay, so and that's quite common to other areas in California too, like Paso Robles, for example. They have a similar cool night scenario, and the Canaris region down by the San Francisco Bay, again, is a similar effect, which is very helpful to making sure that the grapes flourish.
Yeah, that is correct. I mean, if you take other pockets of Sonoma County, let's say Alexander Valley, which is much more inland and isolated from the Bay influence, it's much hotter overall and it stays warmer at night. And you know, in that regard, Cabernet does very well there. If you were to try to grow Cabernet in Green Valley, it would be a nightmare, you know, just getting it ripe now, to a level that's expected.
Right. Now, interestingly, we had a lovely visit to a wine property in the Alexander Valley at a Jordan winery. And there, yeah, they make two wines. They make a Cabernet Sauvignon, but they also make a Chardonnay.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got to be tolerant of some fairly high temperatures if you have them, correct?
Correct. You know, Chardonnay is fairly forgiving, I think, as a variety. Pinot Noir is much less forgiving. Heat doesn't do well with Pinot, and all the Pinot I've tried over the years that is grown, let's say in a place like Alexander Valley, it just does not do well for that grape. Chardonnay, I think, can take it. That said, there's still stylistic differences, I would imagine, from an Alexander Valley Chardonnay to a Green Valley. And, you know, without lining them up side by side, it's hard to say exactly what someone else is making. Green Valley in Russian River Valley is essentially planted exclusively to Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and a little bit of Sauvignon Blanc.
And in fact, it's a hotbed of making sparkling wines. We can't call them champagne, of course, because Pinot Noir and Chardonnay are the grapes that go into sparkling wines, wherever they're made, I guess.
Yeah, and that's indicative for the same reasons. It's just good acidity and you know, bright fruit character, apples, and little less of the peach character, just, you know, vibrancy is what Green Valley is great at making.
Great. Now let's separate those two wines for a second, because I asked you before we came on the air, are you buying the fruit to make the Chardonnay, or are you growing it yourself? And tell us about that arrangement that you have.
Yeah, this is Bill. The Green Valley Chardonnay in particular comes from Dutton Ranch Mill Station Vineyard, and the Dutton family has been entrenched in Green Valley farming for decades, started by Warren Dutton. And if you were to go to Green Valley or Russian River Valley and ask, you know, who the top grower is, it would be the Dutton family. You know, they make an incredible array of wines with their fruit. They don't make the wines, I'm sorry. You know, their fruit is used by a laundry list of the top 20 wineries in the region. And so we've had a partnership with the Duttons going back. In fact, the Martin Ray himself, when he was still alive, purchased fruit with the Duttons. And so part of our success, I guess, and perhaps even our ability to make wines at a great price, is that we have not invested in purchasing land. We would rather contract with somebody like the Dutton family, who is excellent at farming. They know the land. They know how to grow the best grapes that are possible and sell them to us, and then we can make the wine. And so it's a relationship we have with the Duttons and other growers, where it's essentially a partnership. We rely on them to grow the best fruit, and we have some input, of course, on how it's done. And they bring us the best grapes possible, and then it's my job not to screw it up from there.
You guys, you're all so modest, you all say that. The objective is to get out of the way and not mess it up.
Exactly. Well, winemaking is like any, and it's not like any food processing, but you imagine any raw ingredient. If you own a factory and you make some sort of food, you know, your raw ingredients are where you start from. And if you have garbage in, you're going to get garbage out. So like the organic food movement and, you know, natural foods, all that sort of thing, growing great grapes with tons of flavor that are naturally balanced is really the trick, because then you bring them to the winery, there's very little you need to do other than, I mean, obviously there's some oak selection and yeast choices and that sort of thing. But, you know, my job is to sort of steward it through the process and let it be itself. That's the greatest success.
Now, the Pinot Noir for you is a new venture, and it's different. Because you're actually growing those grapes yourself.
We've had a vineyard on the property for 100 years. This vineyard was replanted about 5-6 years ago, and it's always been Pinot as far as I know, but we replanted to some new clones. And so part of the joy of having this vineyard is having 6 or 7 blocks of different clonal types of Pinot, which gives you a little bit of variety in color, spice, flavor, aromatics. So it's fun to play with these and bring them in and ferment them separately and then leave them separate up until the point of blending, and then we can, you know, really work with what makes the best wine there. So having a little bit more control over that is certainly enjoyable, but we also kind of enjoy deferring some of the farming to other growers that we work with.
Add something to that as well.
Of course.
So this is Andy speaking. So in 2014, we have just released our inaugural vintage of our estate Pinot Noir, and it's a beautiful wine that's very elegant and light because the fruit is young. And the winemaking team did a great job with it. You know, they reduced the amount of oak, and they really let the fruit of that vineyard show through. So we made about 140 cases of that from that vineyard. And in addition to that, they also, in the process, made us about 90 cases of estate rosé Pinot Noir, which is absolutely delicious. And we will be releasing that in February. So we're very excited about having, you know, some fruit to call our own and some wine to call estate. And so, you know, those are available, you know, at the winery and through our website as well.
Now, it's an absolutely wonderful mouthful, I have to say. I haven't tasted a Pinot I liked any better for years and years and years. And it reminds me most not of a California Pinot Noir, but of an Oregon Pinot Noir. Do you sense that as well? You must know some of the great producers in that state.
Yeah, I would say, this is Bill speaking, you know, I would say the Pinot represents, you know, a lot of the land in the flavor. I mean, you get sort of a wildness to it, and I hate to use the word earthiness, but it's restrained in the oak and restrained in it's very common nowadays for people to make these Pinot blends that are really over the top, over extracted, or just hits you over the head. And I think by allowing kind of a natural elegance to come out, you know, it's a much more enjoyable glass or bottle or case.
Would you call it more Burgundian, maybe? I mean, is that a nice way of putting it?
That's a very nice compliment to call it Burgundian, or even you know, similar to some of the Oregon wines. I think, like I said, it's made in a way that we try to make it in a natural fashion, where it's just the way the fruit should be done, and it's not doctored up and overblown to the extreme, which is honestly been a fairly popular style in recent years of California Pinot. So we've tried to retain some elegance and ties back to historic Pinot character, which people really love.
Now, there has been a negative campaign about Chardonnay by people who call themselves the ABC movement.
Yeah.
Anything but Chardonnay. Do you have any observation about how your Chardonnay doesn't fall into that category?
Well, I think with most of these wines that we do, and the Chardonnay in particular, we make them so they go well with food. And over-oaked, over-buttery, you know, over-flabby Chardonnays are not great food wines, and it's not something you'd want to drink with your dinner or even, you know, alone on a porch or whatever. But Courtney Benham, the owner of Martin Ray, you know, is really big on making wines that pair well with food. And that's how he drinks his wines. And he's a lover of Chablis and higher acidity type wines. And that's how I would say our Mill Station Chardonnay, you know, fits into that category of a great food wine that's got good brightness, good acidity, and structure that holds up well and is not overblown with California oak. You know?
I used an adjective in talking with Anne as we were drinking the wine with dinner. I said there's an adjective that springs to mind, and that's steely. And interestingly enough, there's a well-known and very good California winemaker called Steele. And and if I'm reminded of any other Chardonnay from California that I've drunk, this would be the closest comparison I think I could make. Are you familiar with Steele, and do you agree or not?
Yeah, I would. I mean, Steele is sourced from a different location, and so I'm sure there's some differences there. But restrained elegance is what we're looking for, and I would say we keep our alcohols moderate as well, so they're drinkable. I mean, you want to be able to have a glass or two without falling over. And keeping them balanced is really the key. And having not tasted Steele recently, I couldn't tell you exactly, but I think that, you know, the producers that are doing well with Chardonnay these days are leaning toward a more natural style of Chardonnay.
Good. Now,
This is Andy talking. And sure, when we bring people, you know, when people come to the tasting room and they say they're part of this anything but Chardonnay, I always take that as a challenge, because I think that, you know, we have converted a fair amount of those folks and sent them home with cases of our Chardonnay. But when I tell them, you know, what to expect when they taste, I tell them to expect getting fruit on the fore palate, a little bit of the oak and the malolactic fermentation in the mid palate, but there's always that bright acidity on the end that cleans your palate off, and it makes you want to go back for another taste. And I hope you had seen that when you had tasted the wine the other night, because it really does. I mean, in the balance of the fruit and acid is really what, you know, I think for us is makes a great Chardonnay, because it really does pair well in food. It, you know, and it balances so well.
Good. Now,
This is Andy talking. And sure, when people come to the tasting room and they say they're part of this anything but Chardonnay, I always take that as a challenge, because I think that, you know, we have converted a fair amount of those folks and sent them home with cases of our Chardonnay. But when I tell them, you know, what to expect when they taste, I tell them to expect getting fruit on the fore palate, a little bit of the oak and the malolactic fermentation in the mid palate, but there's always that bright acidity on the end that cleans your palate off, and it makes you want to go back for another taste. And I hope you had seen that when you had tasted the wine the other night, because it really does. I mean, in the balance of the fruit and acid is really what, you know, I think for us is a, you know, makes a great Chardonnay, because it really does pair well in food. It you know, and it balances so well that, you know, you excited just to drink it on its own, you find it very refreshing, but very full on the palate.
The only sadness that I have, Bill and Andy, is that we didn't have two friends with us at dinner, and we didn't have two bottles. I think that says it all. And
well, there's more where that came from.
Great. Now, any plans to do anything else that's new? The Pinot is a new project, in a sense. Is there anything new coming down the pipe?
Well, if I could speak to that, we have been in the last year, we've really been kind of changing our wine program here at the winery for our, you know, direct-to-consumer wines that we sell at the tasting room and through our wine club. And we've been focusing on the development of more single vineyard wines. So the Dark Star Hill that you've tasted, we also have a beautiful Sonoma Coast. We make also, kind of as an homage to Martin Ray, we still make a Santa Cruz Chardonnay, we make a Santa Cruz Pinot Noir, and we make a Santa Cruz Mountain Cabernet Sauvignon. So we have, you know, we're hand-picking vineyards and regions that we feel that make, you know, and grow and produce amazing fruit, and then we're bringing those back so that we have a palate of wines that you can choose, and there's always one that, you know, everyone loves one of our wines because they are so different. We have four single vineyard Chardonnays currently, and coming out in 2015, I think we're going to be up to seven or eight single vineyard Pinot Noirs. So those, you know, those really, each one of those wines are different in the sense that they come from a different vineyard or a different region or in some cases a different appellation.
Yeah, you're growing some grapes down near our good friend Randall Graham in Santa Cruz.
Yeah, in fact, one of our best, you know, Cabernet selections from Santa Cruz Mountains is right across the road from Ridge Vineyards.
Oh, there you go.
You know, within a mile of the historic Martin Ray site. We're in good company down there, and it's. I take great joy as the winemaker here to be able to get grapes from those kind of places, because I know a lot of winemakers that only get fruit from their own property, and it seems like it'd get a little boring. But here, you know, we're allowed to really tap into, as Andy said, to some of the best that the regions have to offer, and we're not talking a lot of fruit. We're, you know, a few tons here and there of these different blocks, and pick them, and we bring them to the winery, and we do the rest here. It's incredibly exciting, and the diversity is what makes it really fun.
And of course, you ship, and you can buy online. So let's make sure before we close that our listeners know where to reach you so that they can shop.
Our website is martinraywinery.com. On the website, we have our current releases. We also have we list our limited release wines that are available to the wine club. And then also we have large format bottles. And predominantly what we offer on the website is our Chardonnays, our Pinot Noir, and our Cabernet Sauvignons, as well as we have some really fun summer wines. Like we did a Rhone-style white blend. We have our Rosé. And so we also have a single vineyard Sauvignon Blanc from the Dutton Ranch, and that is the George Vineyard. And so, you know, very small productions. The Chardonnay, or the Sauvignon Blanc, I'm sorry, was 60 cases. The Rhone style was about 50 cases. And so, you know, these wines are just fun wines that are available to our wine club and to our visitors.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure to talk to you both. We hope you have a great vintage in 2016. It sounds like it's off to a good start with a little rain coming down, which is welcome. Thank you so much for a very interesting discussion.
Peter, thank you very much.
So there you have it. Until this time next week, we hope you'll join us same time, same place. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.